that this is the comedy panel, will you please dismiss it from your mind? Because there is nothing more dispiriting than being labelled as the comedy panel. So we're going to be extremely serious, and if anyone says anything that makes you crack the smallest smile, please convert it into a laugh. Okay. Well, I'm joined by four fine exponents of the crime genre to discuss a topic of vital interest to all of us. As mystery fiction descends into ever more Stygian realms of noir, is there still room on its palette for less murky tones? Can it accommodate the battleship grey of levity, the pigeon feather grey of outright humour, or that whiter shade of pale that makes people laugh out loud? Can crime and comedy coexist?
No, it's just awful.
Yes, it is awful. Well, that is the question that I'm going to put in turn to each of our panellists before we open out into more general discussion, and then in the final part of the session, we will solicit questions from you, our invaluable audience. So I'm going to turn first to K.C. Hill, whose first novel, Dead Woman's Shoes, received excellent critical reaction, and whose second, The Fall Girl, is due for publication in August. I've read the first one, and I think you manage very well the balance between crime and comedy. Is it something that comes naturally to you?
Yes, yeah. Anything that I write, I can't write anything serious. It always descends into humour, which is why I failed my maths O level. Pythagoras should not be taken with levity.
Right. Are we going to leave it at that? Fine, for the moment, because we're going to move on. Now, those of you who come all the way from furthest parts of the world to see Bill James, it's tough, but he's not here. But we have a wonderful replacement in the form of Elsie, as in, yes, Gert and Daisy, Elsie Tyler, whose first crime novel was called The Herring Seller's Apprentice, and whose next will be 10 Little Herrings. Something fishy going on. He also has just reminded me of something that I was totally unaware, that I once awarded him fourth prize in a beauty... that's Monopoly. Fourth prize in a short story competition. He's also written a non-crime novel called A Very Persistent Illusion. Now, I'm sorry, I can't call you LJ. It sounds like something out of Dallas. Len.
Len, I think, is,
Len.
Yes.
Where do you stand on crime and comedy? Can they coexist?
Well, I'm tempted to say I think you're absolutely right, and they can't, and my entire literary career up to this point has been a complete mistake. And there's obviously some truth in that remark. I have to say I didn't actually set out to write comic crime. I set out to write a humorous book, which just somehow turned into a crime novel as I was writing it. And I think, like all writers, there were stages when I was writing it, when I read through it and thought, God, this is crap. No one is ever going to read this. It's all going completely wrong. And the points at which I did that, I think, was because I was thinking crime and comedy really don't go together terribly well. I had this poor girl who'd been brutally murdered, and all the characters in my book actually seemed to find this rather amusing. And they came across as rather unrealistic and uncaring. And although I solved that, a couple of sort of things happened to me in real life, mm-hmm. which I think illustrated the limits of comedy, as it were. I have to say, we live in London in a very quiet sort of garden square in Islington, where nothing much happens. But over the course of about 3 months, we had two crimes occurring in the square, which actually made the front pages of the national dailies. And the first wasn't actually funny in any way at all. A young boy got into an argument in a nightclub and was stabbed and killed. Ben Kinsella, if anyone remembers the case. And the family lived on the other side of the square, and we knew them by sight. We knew them well enough that we really wanted to go round and see them and say how terrible it was. But not well enough that they really knew very much about us. And the thing that I was really worried would come up in the conversation was that they would say to me, and what do you do? And I was going to have to say to this family, not just, I write crime, but I write humorous crime. And that just sort of brought it home to me that this maybe was a slightly distasteful thing. But the other thing that happened was perhaps slightly more amusing in some ways, because a few months after Ben Kinsella was killed, the house was firebombed in the square. Sorry, it really is a very quiet square for North London. And it was because a publisher lived there, and he was about to publish. Absolutely. So he deserved it. He deserved everything he got. And he was about to publish a book called The Jewel of Medina, which was about the life of the Prophet Muhammad. And one or two people took exception, and some Islamic terrorists turned up one night to firebomb his house. The police knew that they were coming. So the square had been staked out, and there were about 40 policemen either hiding in vans or in people's flats or impersonating parking wardens or whatever in the square waiting for these terrorists to turn up. The family had been sent off to a hotel and were completely safe. But the police couldn't do anything until the terrorists had struck. So they had to wait until they'd actually put the firebomb through the letterbox. At which point they all looked at each other and said, who's got the key to the house? And nobody had. So they had to stand there while this fire slowly took hold and wait until the fire brigade came round to break down the door and put out the fire. And the amusing thing from my point of view was that I was actually, it was nighttime, I was in bed at the time, and my wife Anne woke me up and sort of said, you know, there are fire engines in the square, there are policemen in the square. And I said, oh, it's of no interest whatsoever. Just let me sleep. Thus missing the only crime that actually occurred in front of me ever. But it did seem to me that that actually had comic possibilities.
Yes, and, I mean, a great, you know, tribute to the British police system. Ruth, let's move on to you. Now, Ruth Dudley Edwards manages still to be taken seriously as a respected political commentator while writing extremely scurrilous books which send up most of our revered national institutions. The characteristically combative title of her most recent is Murdering Americans. The thing with Ruth's titles is they do what they say on the tin. Ruth, can crime and comedy coexist?
It doesn't sell.
No, that's true. I was going to come on to that. We'll have a moan about that later.
All comedy panels end up with some self-pitying person raising the fact that it doesn't sell, and all the others descending into gloom.
Yes.
So I've raised it early. Okay. I don't know, because I'm like Kay. I can't write anything serious. I have to write seriously in my non-fiction life a bit. But it's very hard to keep the jokes out. So fiction is a release. I set out to write an ordinary crime novel, and by page 3, I'd killed somebody with a sculpture called Reconciliation. I didn't mean to. And I killed somebody in a recent book. He was wearing a T-shirt saying peace, I think it was. The Anglo-Irish peace process. I just see funny side of things. I can top your story about poor Ben Kinsella's family. I'm right. My present book is about the Omagh bomb and the families who are taking a civil case against the bombers. And I had the excruciating happening of, because I'm very close to the families, and I was having a book launch of Carnage on the Committee in Belfast. and the family member I'm particularly close to happened to be up in Belfast for a meeting, and I had to ask him to the book launch, and fortunately he's sophisticated, but I had to say not to mention it to the others, because it just wasn't, because what people say about Omagh all the time is carnage. So, but even on the Omagh book, I do find there are things that have made me laugh over the last several years, and they do get into footnotes, I tell you. Even with something like that, you need a laugh. So I can't help it. That's my defence.
Thank you. I'm delighted to welcome as our fourth panellist, all the way from Sweden, via London, I think, at the moment, Håkan Nesser, whose most recent book to be published in this country is Woman with Birthmark, featuring his regular detective, Inspector Van Veeteren. nearly, something like that. Now, Hawken, I hate to say this, but Scandinavian crime writers have got a reputation in this country for being a little bit dour.
Really?
I even, for fictional purposes of my own, invented a Scandinavian crime writer who was called Turgid Blomstedt. And yet you seem extremely bright and cheerful, and I gather have been known to infiltrate jokes into your writing. Do you think there's a place for humour in crime fiction?
Well, not really. I mean, it's, and I'm Swedish, and I'm supposed to be suicidal and depressive and the Ingmar Bergman style. So, but I agree that amongst my fellow writers in Sweden, there is a lot of gloom and doom. And Henning Mankell, even in Sweden, he's notoriously well known for never cracking one joke in ever. He's extremely serious, and but I think that's also because he's so very political and. When it comes, if you are sort of, if your mission as a writer is to criticize society, it's difficult to be everything. You can't be too comical, I think. And he never cracks a joke in his books. But and there is one thing, as you've already said, that you can't talk about being funny. You can't talk about your own humor. I mean, to me, I try to be serious. I know I am a serious writer, and I've written 22 novels so far, and half of them are crime fiction and half of them are at least cross-genre. But I never, ever set out to be funny. But, I mean, sometimes when you're deep in deep shit, you need to put some light to it, and that's what you do. But a bleak kind of humour, yes, but don't overdo it.
Mm-hmm. Right. I remember, whenever I think of this, I remember something I was told by wonderful actress Joan Sanderson, who I'm sure you all remember as the Deaf Lady in 40 Towers, and she was actually in my television series After Henry, and she lived in a little village in the Cotswolds, and they had one of these terrible tragedies there where an elderly couple, both in their 80s, suddenly one day the husband took a shotgun, turned it on his wife, killed himself. Terrible tragedy, but needless to say, in a small village, a lot of gossip. And Joan said she was in the village shop a week or so after this happened, and she heard the woman in front of her saying to the shopkeeper, "But it's so strange. I mean, they've never done anything like that before." I would like to move back a little historically, because if we look at the golden age of crime fiction, I mean, it seems that crime fiction and high spirits, you know, were very much, they just went together. I mean, if you think of a lot of Agatha Christie, the crime was a kind of, you know, it's turning the key in a wonderful clockwork toy. I just wonder, do you think it's because our perceptions have changed, or have we, you know, why has crime got so far away from high spirits? Okay, any thoughts?
I think there's a tendency to take ourselves a lot more seriously these days somehow. I don't know why it is. It might have just been, you know, the fact that the two world wars, you know, made people a little bit more enforced jolliness. Now we've got nothing to really, we haven't got that spirit to keep us together. You know, just maybe that could be the reason.
Len, do you have thoughts?
Well, I'm rather hoping that with the sort of current economic depression, so everybody's going to turn back towards crime, and we are the future.
Yeah,
we are the future of crime writing.
I'm glad to hear it. I mean, I have heard the theory put forward that it's partly to do with the end of the death penalty. That you know, in the Golden Age, it was wonderful because you could get to the final scene in the library and Hercule Poirot could say, "Therefore, the murderer, because the top was not on the toothpaste, was you," and that was the end. You know, no loose ends. He was taken off and hanged. And I think, you know, capital punishment only in the world of crime fiction was very handy. Ruth,
because there was. Nowadays, Poirot would be sued for invasion of privacy or something by the murderer.
Yes,
this would be the difficulty.
That's true.
I mean, my problem, I've got another whinge. I mean,
go on. She's talking about torture in the next panel, so she's really getting stuff off her
chest. That's where the jokes happen.
Yeah, okay, all right.
Yes, the first whinge is, why is he a participating moderator? Does that mean that he's more important than all the other moderators? That's what it says. It even says it on your card.
I think it means I'm allowed to say things other than, what do you think? I think it does.
Yes, I just wanted.
What you wanted to
that was a very minor
okay.
whinge. All right. It was just for
bigger
the sake
whinge.
Of form.
Move to your bigger whinge.
It's. I'm a satirist, really, and you know, pity the poor satirist is what I say about five times a week. I mean, look at Westminster. it's priceless. It's wonderful. But could I have made that up? And would anybody have allowed me to put it?
No.
I mean, would anybody have made up the moat? Could you make that up?
It's very good.
And I have my gag. I'm pleased with this gag. I have invented a new firm. If I don't know if you've been following this, but John Selwyn Gummer.
It's difficult to avoid it.
John Selwyn Gummer charged us £100 for getting rid of moles. And Douglas Hogg, as you know, I think everybody knows he had a moat which needed a bit of repair. So I have thought of Gummer and Hogg, mole catchers and moat clearers. by appointment.
Yeah, I think they'll. Hawken, do you have a relationship with the golden age of crime fiction?
I mean, when I was a teenager, I read it, but that was the time I did it, when I was from 15 to 20, and I was also a teacher, and I think that it's if you read children's books and then you want to get onto something called literature, I mean, the bridge to literature is crime fiction, or the golden age crime fiction like Agatha Christie, etc. But nowadays I wouldn't read it again. No, I think it's to me it's the classical old whodunits. Why would I read it again? I know what it's about, so it's not.
No,
it's not serious enough. As you said, I don't want to read comedy.
No.
But, I mean, that's me, and as a reader. Yeah.
Well, that's a sweet.
But as a sweet, exactly.
But I think, actually, that thing you were saying about the bridge for, you know, young readers, because I remember my daughter, when she was about 12, the first adult book she read was an Agatha Christie. And she said, "Oh, just read this wonderful book called Lord Edgware Dies." She'd never heard it spoken, I think. There's one thing I would like to raise. I mean, there is obviously a moral dimension to this. You know, should one be... Does one have a moral duty to have respect for certain subjects? Or do you think anything is fair game in what you write about, in what you write humorously about?
I think anything is fair game... if the joke's good enough.
Right.
And, you know, Jews crack jokes in concentration camps. That's how you deal with things. And one thing that my background as Irish, we do black humour quite well. Mm. And it comes in really handy in life, I find.
Yeah.
But there really isn't any... Even death of a best friend, you know, she had a terrific sense of humour, and the gags I was furious I couldn't share with her during the funeral.
No, I mean, there are some, I think, you know, people... there's a supposed to be true story of Arthur Askey, when he was... Arthur Askey, an English comedian, when he was dying, he was very ill, and he had gangrene, and he had to have one of the legs amputated. And so Showbiz friend sent him a telegram saying... congratulations, start filming Long John Silver on Monday. And then, unfortunately, the illness got worse, and he had to have the other leg amputated, and the same friend sent him a telegram saying, all right, you've got the part. Kay, do you have any... Is there a boundary you wouldn't step over? Is there anything you wouldn't treat humorously?
I mean, I think one has to respect you know, the dead, and I don't really get too close to bodies and corpses. I tend to sort of be a bit vague when that happens, and my books tend to be more about the mystery and the puzzle than actually laughing about death as such.
Yeah.
So it's not particularly black, my type of humour, more gentle.
Len?
I think Ruth's right that you can actually make jokes about pretty well anything, but I think if the question is what you actually feel comfortable making jokes about personally. So in my books, I wouldn't put comedy rape. I wouldn't put comedy child abuse. I think that there are things that I personally would feel are beyond the limits of good taste, and I wouldn't want to be, you know, I wouldn't want to actually admit to having written. That said, I think the scope is still pretty broad.
When you kill a good guy, you shouldn't joke about it. When you kill a bad guy, you can joke about it.
No, because that, I remember, because all of my books have been fairly light-hearted, and one of them I had to stop and start again because I'd made the victim too sympathetic, you know, and it, you couldn't be funny about it because the emotions were engaged. There's a kind of, I guess the danger with comedy is that, I mean, usually comedy is done, you know, comic relief is the expression we use, so you build up tension and then you deflate it. But, I mean, I think there are some writers, Raymond Chandler springs to mind, who can actually, he can crank up the tension with a joke, which I think is a wonderful skill. I'm not sure that I can do that, and I wish I could. But I think we are treading a kind of tightrope between the two, you know, being too silly. Have you ever worried about being too silly, Ruth?
It's other people who worry about me being too silly.
Really? it's never
it's done for me.
Right. Len, too silly?
Oh, my editor worries about me being too silly quite a lot.
Yeah.
And gets rid of anything that's that is excessively silly. He keeps saying to me, Len, you've got to understand that less is more when it comes to humour.
I think that is certainly true of comedy.
I had a very good editor once who tried to get me to put in sex and violence in my books.
Oh, yes.
And I put in a violent scene and she just laughed.
I think this is the danger, because I know Tim Heald, who used to write crime novels about Simon Bognor, though he wasn't called Simon Bognor when he started. I thought he was called Simon Villiers. And he thought it was a straight novel. And until he showed it to an editor, he said, well, this is funny, you know, and he said, is it? And so he changed the name from Villiers to Bognor. And in fact, there is quite a tradition of towns on the south coast featuring as names of detectives, because you've got Captain Hastings, Inspector Dover, Simon Bognor. You can just move your way along the south coast.
Did he do it just so somebody would say bugger?
Now, the other thing that Tim used to do was he used the names of people as villages, and he invented two villages. Sadly, neither of the people is still alive, but he had the village of Sheridan Morley and the village of Miles Kington, which I thought was rather sweet. Yes, do you have any views on a subject that you wouldn't touch for taste grounds?
No, but I was thinking about the story about Halldór Laxness, you know, the Icelandic Nobel Prize winner, who was a very gloomy fellow. He didn't crack a lot of jokes, but he was very serious. And I remember a story about him. You may have heard it, but I'll just tell it briefly. He was sitting. He had just had his Nobel Prize, and he was the big shot in this conference. And he participated in every panel, and he didn't say a word. He just kept quiet. And the organizers they got pissed off with him. And at the last panel, they asked him to, could you please, Mr. Laxness, sum up what we've achieved so far during this conference? And he sat for a while, and then he said, to my mind, you should never kill more people than you are prepared to eat. Thank you. And the result was, of course, that everybody forgot everything that they had achieved during, but everybody, they remembered his punchline, and that was he killed the conference. But he didn't eat it.
This could be a new competition for Crime Fest, actually, the summation of the entire conference. Yes. That's wonderful. I love it. There's another thing that, I mean, some real-life crimes actually do seem funny. And I don't know why it is, but, I mean, there are some which just seem absolutely awful and some which seem funny, and I don't know whether it's the people involved. But, I mean, the appalling crimes of Fred and Rosemary West, I could never take entirely seriously, because when they were interviewed, they just sounded like, you know, sort of lovable Edge Cutler in the Wurzels. I mean, I don't know, are there any crimes which you actually, real life crimes that you find funny, apart from MPs' expenses, obviously? Len?
Well, there was an almost crime that happened near us when we were in Canterbury. And it was round about the time that people were worried about terrorists sort of spreading biological weapons, sort of by white dust and stuff. And a man was found in the crypt of Canterbury Cathedral, scattering white dust all over the place and was immediately arrested. And it transpired that the poor man was just scattering his wife's ashes.
Oh, la la.
But I thought that was funny.
I think I would tend to agree. Kay, can you think any real-life crimes which have amused you?
Well, one thing that did occur to me was that I'm always really conscious or scared of the fact that my death might be amusing.
Oh, yeah.
An anvil falling on me from above or something.
Big Monty
like
Python
that.
Foot.
Yeah.
Yes. Well, it's very difficult to militate against that, actually,
it
isn't
is,
it?
It's very difficult,
you
yes.
Never
yes,
go out, but then it could happen at home.
Yes, exactly.
Because there are some, I mean, it's like poor, you know, Rod Hull of Rod Hull and Emu. He fell through his conservatory roof fixing his television aerial.
Yes,
and I mean, it's something, it's very difficult. Anyway, Hawken, any real life instances that have amused you?
I'm not sure, but I'm not sure that I would like to have an amusing death. If you get old enough, and then you can I could really enjoy that. I mean, he died in, at least he died well.
Yes.
So yeah, what was the question again?
I was thinking. I mean, some people think that Bing Crosby's was the perfect death because he died on the golf course. I can't imagine anything worse. But apparently, he liked golf, which I mean,
yeah, yeah.
But imagine God dying with golfers around you.
Yeah.
It would be absolutely awful. Yes?
Well, I like to spread happiness, so I'd be delighted to die an amusing death if it'll make you all laugh.
Yes, and I guess
Might be good for
Tommy Cooper. I mean, dying, you know, telling jokes on live telly.
That's all right.
That's all right.
Yeah.
Yes.
But can I get back for a second to doing a very serious book, which I am, obviously, the Uma book. But it's just the way that real life is ridiculous. Beyond satire, we're the same barrister for all the time, since 2001. This is how long the case has taken. It's only just finished. And he had a heart attack in the House of Lords. And, you know, it would have been utterly catastrophic for the case, really, if he had gone. But his description of it is, he has this heart attack, he's speaking, he's a very devout Catholic, he's speaking on the embryology bill, he has this heart attack, and fortunately he's surrounded by doctors who proceed to save his life. And he said he woke up, and of course he could see this ceiling, this ornate gilt ceiling, and all around him were praying bishops. And he said, I thought for a moment I'd gone to paradise, but then I realised they were Anglicans. And then he went to hospital, he got his pacemaker, he came back 2 weeks later in order to make another contribution to the embryology bill, and he had just finished thanking everybody for saving his life, being so kind, so supportive, when he fell down again. His pacemaker malfunctioned.
Oh.
But it was fine. It was all fine. He just popped around the corner and they saved him again, and he's been fine ever since, and he's doing a terribly good
job.
But,
you
know, how can you... You have to pause in a book about lawyers and death and terrible stuff to relate that.
You have to take the pacemaker out if it's going to be a cremation. No, seriously.
Right.
Because they do... They tend to explode.
Well, I don't think he'd approve of cremation.
And also, apparently, in some West Indian communities, they bury coconuts in the coffin, and those explode too.
Yeah.
I just pass this on, so if you hear strange noises from the crematorium, it's either a pacemaker or a rain. I once judged a painting competition for school children, which was organised by a local funeral office. And I remember two things. I was researching a book about funeral directors, and I got a friend who said she'd show me round. She worked as one, and she said, "Do you want to see the chapel of rest?" And I said, "Oh, I would like to." And so, as she led me through reception, she said, "Oh, anybody in?" which I thought was quite nice. But the other thing, after I judged this painting competition, my wife and I were taken out to lunch by the funeral directors. I was talking about ashes, and he said, "Oh, now, when you say ashes, what you really refer to is non-combustible solids." So always bear that in mind. You know, we could end up as non-combustible solids. And actually, a friend of mine has just gone to New Zealand to scatter her father's ashes because he was born there, which I think is quite a nice idea. But I saw her the evening before she was going. She said, "I can't find them." So it seems a long way to go. If you, anyway, yeah, I'd like to talk a bit about the structure, because it seems to me I write sort of straight comedy and crime, which has some comedy in it. And it seems to me that there's a great similarity in crime plotting and comedy plotting. I wonder if any of you have had that experience. Len?
I think I started to write crime because I was having such difficulty with my plots in non-crime novels, because certainly with cosy crime, you do tend to work to a structure, mm-hmm. A structure which I've sort of found terribly helpful in putting the stories together. So I think I turned to crime for exactly that for exactly that reason. And I think perhaps cosy crime can be slightly formulaic for that reason, that you have your stock of 12 suspects and you have to go through them one after the other, and you know, you'll suspect each of them in turn. So I guess that's my take on it.
I'm not sure that, I mean, I would say it's formulaic in that you tend to start with a crime and you tend to end with a solution, or hopefully a resolution. But how you get between those two points
is
really
absolutely is personal choice. Yes,
yeah. I mean, one of the things that appeals to me about crime fiction is that you can actually write about whatever you want to write about. Mm. I was once on a radio panel with Reginald Hill, and he said, "You know, writing crime fiction has never stopped me from writing about what I wanted to write about." Mm. And I think that's, you know, you can actually explore things that interest you. Mm. I mean, have you found that?
Yeah, also because I mean, you have sort of a fake focus on the killing thing, and then you can. And when you start on a crime story and you know it's a crime story, you know that sooner or later or in the last chapter they will find out who did it. And but the journey from the body, from the corpse to the last chapter, you can do anything you like, I think. But because as a reader you realize, oh, it's a crime story, but it's so interesting, and the deviations are the things that are interesting in crime stories. So you have a, I mean, this structure creates a lot of freedom actually for the writer, I think.
Yeah. Do you find it helps, having that structure?
Well, crime is sort of bound by rules, you know, perhaps more so than any other type of fiction, you know, because we have to be fair to the reader, and we have to provide the solution at the end, you know, which is not necessarily the same in mainstream fiction. But yeah, as Harkin says, it's, you can have great fun on the journey, and I particularly like characters and building characters, and my lead character, you know, you have great license to make them do what you want them to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's another, freedom is a good word, because, you know, if you're, I mean, I wrote 17 Charles Parris crime novels. There's no way I could have written 17 literary novels about the same character. But actually, as you get along, you can explore the character, find out new things about them, put them in different situations. I mean, your Troutbeck lady, has she developed as a character through her various...
Well, she's a dreadful cow. She had a walk-on part, and she took over.
Really?
Yeah. Mm. Completely. So, yes, does she develop?
But are you finding out new things about her as you go along?
Oh, I am. Oh, yes, one always does. But I want to pick up on Len's point, really. What I do in non-fiction obviously has a structure. You know, if you're writing somebody's biography, you can't stray away from the facts. You're stuck. So fiction is a great release, absolutely fantastic release. But I don't find that I'm bound by rules at all. I mean, it would be bad manners not to tell them in the end what happened. One must always have good manners.
Yes.
But otherwise, I do what I like, and I don't plot anything. I just know who I'm going to kill and what the environment is. And then the rest happens. And I don't plot the comedy either. Comedy just happens. I really get people in my books. I mean, people I don't like, I will always kill in a book later.
I mean, that is a revenge afforded to few, actually. Mm. When I was a television producer at London Weekend, I had a very difficult PA who made my life rather difficult, because she thought I'd come from radio and knew nothing about television. I mean, she was right, but she didn't have to tell everyone who came in the office. But and she kept saying, "I know what you'll do, Simon. You'll write one of your crime novels and you'll kill me off at the end of the first chapter, won't you?" And I said, "That's a jolly good idea, Philip." And after I left, I did write this book called Situation Tragedy, set around a situation comedy at a fairly recognisable London Weekend called West End Television. And at the end, I couldn't manage end of the first chapter, but at the end of the second chapter, a particularly obnoxious PA was pushed off a fire escape into the car park and splatted, and I changed the colour of her hair and all kinds of physical details so that nobody would know. But I sent her a copy when I got my copies from the publisher, and she rang me up and she said, "Thank you very much for the book, Simon. I enjoyed it." You know, I think it's wonderful. I think that's why crime writers tend to be fairly benign, because, you know, you hear about the romantic novelists flouncing around all over the place, and they go to all these conventions, and they've got these name badges which go halfway down to their waist because they've got so many pseudonyms. But crime writers are, generally speaking, fairly benign. Benign, are you, Hawken?
Oh, yes, definitely.
Good.
I'm tall but benign, yes.
Benign, yeah. Tall, benign, yeah. And not dour.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, yes. Okay, well, I think what I'd like to do now is open out to questions from... And remember, the most interesting, vivid or rare question, the questioner will get a goodie bag of goodies.
What are the rules? Who decides?
What are the rules? No, I think we mutually will decide which is the most interesting question.
And if we disagree?
I will overrule you. Democracy. Okay. Oh, yes.
Yeah. It was just a comment, really, to go on with the, humour in real life. My husband's an accountant, and he went to a class...
That's quite funny. Wonderful. I love it. Gosh. But I mean, that's presumably where all the money went, did it? The wives and mistresses.
All the six wives and the 30 mistresses, yeah. All who were convinced that, their favourite other person in the room had all the money. And there wasn't any.
I think that's wonderful. And I must say, one might put up with not having anyone coming to one's funeral. Yes, at the back. Okay, let's go to you first on that.
Well, for me, it's quite easy. Douglas Adams, Dirk Gently, second to none. I think the books are brilliant.
And because of the plot?
I just think the man's a genius. And also Jasper Ford, I enjoy very much. He really seems to hit the spot. And Reginald Hill, of course. Particularly the Joe Sixsmith novels of Reginald Hill, I think are brilliant.
Hawken.
Could I borrow one of yours? Because I can't come up with a name, actually.
Probably most of the ones you know are Swedish.
Yeah, that's the reason. But I don't read a lot of crime. I read mainstream literature, but I mean, I'm not. I just write crime. Mm. It's as easy as that. So, but if I come up with a name, I'll let you know afterwards. Thank you.
Ruth.
Oh, Reg Hill, master. I do like your Mrs. Partridge's.
Oh, bless your heart. You'll go far. Len.
Well, everyone on the panel, Malcolm Price and his Aberystwyth series, if you haven't read them, I think are absolutely, absolutely superb. And Kate Atkinson, if you're happy to have that as comedy, which is crime of, I think, a high literary order as well.
I don't associate the Welsh with comedy any more than the Swedes.
Sitting over there and can,
since Rob Brydon and Gavin Stacey, the Welsh can do no wrong in comedy. Any other names? I mean, I would actually, I know I mentioned him before, but Roman Chandler still makes me, I remember once somebody, an American publisher, somehow got permission for people to write, it was a book called Roman Chandler's Philip Marlowe, and he commissioned contemporary crime writers to write Philip Marlowe's stories, and I actually wrote one, which was a huge pleasure, because it meant rereading all the books together. And what I found I could kind of do the jokes, but I couldn't do them with the economy that he did them. You know, mine were just a bit too wordy. And I think the skill in that writing of actually turning a joke, and as I say, often cranking up tension at the same time, is remarkable. I mean, I would certainly go back. There are laugh-aloud lines in Raymond Chandler that I still, you know, just love.
Yeah, I mean, if you count Raymond Chandler as a comic writer, I'm for it. But I wouldn't. Do you think he would like that?
Oh yes. I mean, nobody could write lines like that and
No.
They were funny. I mean, it was very conscious.
Yeah,
it wasn't his main. It's actually interesting that you mentioned Douglas Adams, because I recently had, they're reissuing the Douglas Adams Hitchhiker books, and because I was the first radio producer of Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, they asked me to do a foreword. And I was trying to find a comparison for Douglas. And I said, you don't read him for the plots, because he was seriously crap at plots. But then so was Raymond Chandler. And in fact, I think they're very similar. You know, you read them just for the imaginative world they create and the language. And so I used that parallel. Anyway, another question. We've had some very good... they're keen on this goodie bag. Yes.
My question is, does humor age? We raised the question yesterday of Michael Innes, and I thought he was very funny. But nobody else agreed with me. And I'm just curious about the past. You talked about Chandler, that's fine, and Doug Adams, but I'm just wondering if you go back further.
That's
how
quite,
does that humor survive?
Yeah, I mean, if you were to go to, say, Carol Brahms and S.J. Simon, you know, a Bullet in the Ballet, was it? I think we'd find that pretty creaky now. What do you think, Ruth?
I'm very interested in Bill's question, because I loved Michael Innes. He and Edmund Crispin were great inspiration to me. And I'm afraid to reread them in case I'll be disappointed.
Yeah.
Well, that was what we found in one of our groups. We reread them, and some of the people just couldn't find anything humorous about them.
Did you still?
I still did. I still think with the Applebee stories, I think, are just great.
Yeah.
Okay, do you have
I'll have the courage to try again.
Yes, I do. I love the old books. I love Edmund Crispin. I love John Dixon Carr. And I still read them, and I still find them really funny. But I think it is very much a matter of personal taste. Because I can understand why someone wouldn't find them funny at the same time. Because they are a little bit creaky. Mm,
yeah.
But
yeah, John Dixon Carr is another good name. Yeah, of course. I loved it. But, I mean, I'm not sure I would reread it and appreciate it now. And my kids wouldn't. Definitely. But I mean, as with anything else, I mean, 10% survives and the rest of it will probably lost in time.
Len, do you have favourites going back a while, or do you think they're dated?
Well, in terms of whether it dates or not, I think it depends how good the humour is. Moving away from crime slightly, if you read a 19th century copy of Punch, which is where I get most of my jokes anyway, most of it is very, very unfunny. If you read Jane Austen, all of her observations come across as absolutely sharp, absolutely funny, absolutely right. So I do think good humour, I think, lasts. Bad humour, I think, dates very, very quickly.
Well, exactly. I mean, but I think there's also an interesting thing that the people who don't date are the people who write about a kind of parallel universe. I mean, you just mentioned Woodhouse, and the world that Woodhouse created never quite existed, so it can't date. Exactly the same with Agatha Christie, you know, this kind of cloud cuckoo land of between the walls where, you know, people go for weekends at stately homes, that kind of thing. And I think almost Jane Austen, actually, because she was kind of detached from the daily realities. And I think that is probably the secret. If you want your work to last, make it in a slightly unreal world, or possibly a created country, Hawken.
Why not?
Yes.
Indeed,
that'd
yes.
That'd be good.
Yes. But perhaps you need to create your own language as well.
Because have you ever named your country?
No, I haven't. I named a few cities and towns and the people, but not the country. But they call it Netherland, and the Germans tend to believe it's somewhere close to Emden, because there is a part of Emden called Netherland, and they so this is where it is, they say. And I say, well, perhaps. It doesn't have a name.
Right. And do you have a geographical image of where it is?
Well, it's somewhere in Northern Europe. So, it's Poland, Germany, Holland. But, I mean, I stopped writing these books like 6-7 years ago, so now I'm into other deep waters.
Right.
Really.
Other deep, noir.
Noir.
Noir waters.
Greyish water. Bleakish Swedish water.
Ayo. Do we get stuck? Oh God, we're creative artists. It is such hell being a writer. You know, the writer's block. Okay, you get stuck.
I don't really, because I think it just comes out naturally. As I said, I can't seem to write anything serious, so you know, as long as I carry on in that vein, I'm okay.
Right.
Okay. Constantly, yes. Yeah. But the thing is to get over it, to find ways out of this the block, and you learn the trade, I think. Mm-hmm. And you mustn't. But I mean, if you're stuck in chapter 22, you start on chapter 23, and just leave it and see if it comes back to you later. And generally, it does.
Len.
Kay's going to have to tell me how you don't get stuck. I mean, it's something that happens all the time. And I find that what happens when I get stuck is very often I send my characters on a road trip somewhere just in the hope that a change of scene. Oh, yeah. So if you read through my books, watch out for the point at which the characters actually get into a car and drive off, and you'll say, yes, that's the point at which you got completely stuck.
That's, yes. Because, of course, with Roman Chandler, it was introduced a man with a gun, wasn't it? Mm. You know, mm-hmm. So when you didn't know what was going to happen next. Ruth, someone as fluent and fertile as yourself, do you ever get stuck?
I find having a large overdraft is a great nature.
That sounds perfect. Yes, yes, gentleman at the back. Yes, you. Yes, I mean, it's the kind of thing that was taken to an extreme, really, in the James Bond films, wasn't it, where you got dreadful puns after people had had unfortunate deaths. I mean, it's lovely when you can do it. I certainly enjoy doing that. If I can build up to a joke, you know, to, I mean, you get the shocking effect and then you have the joke afterwards. That's good. Is it something you use, would you say, Ken?
Having only written two books, I haven't so far. No, I don't think I could. I don't think I could go there really. As I said, I tend to just skirt around the actual death itself and not joke about it. You know, the jokes are all the set pieces coming up to it and afterwards, but definitely not about it.
Right, Ken.
I agree with what you say about Al Guthrie.
Sorry, I called you Ken.
It's all right. Elsie, Len, Ken,
yes.
Any of those is absolutely,
sorry,
absolutely
Ben.
Fine. Ben. Ben. Right, I'll change that again. I agree with what you say about Al Guthrie. I think he mixes humour and hard-boiled crime in a very, very skillful way, and I wish I could do that. In my case, there is very, very little violence in my books that you actually need comic relief from. It's sort of almost one joke follows another, another joke. But I certainly admire people who can do it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, doesn't every good joke comes organically? I mean, if you plan a chapter just to be able to crack a joke towards the end, I think it's, to me, it would be a disaster. I mean, but if you write about something very dark and then you realize that, well, what's the next sentence going to be like? Oh, a joke now. But it comes always sort of automatically, and which perhaps humor should do, I think.
Mm. But I mean, there are wonderful stories that where you just see something. That famous headline in New York, wasn't it? Which was headless body found in topless bar. I always loved that one. Do we have a... Yes, lady here.
We've all agreed, I think, that laughter is very therapeutic, and I believe, indeed, there are surveys by doctors that say this. And perhaps what you really should do to help sell your books is get the National Health Service to issue prescriptions of humorous books. But there would be a slight problem, and I was thinking about it. I wonder if you've got any ideas. What sort of questionnaire might the health service give to the patients to find out what sort of humour?
That's true. Mm. Yes. Yes.
Well, there would be no inappropriate jokes permitted, so
no.
That's me out.
No. Yeah. Well, you think about sex politics.
Yeah.
If you were a surgeon, you could say it keeps you in stitches.
Yes.
I have to point out that doesn't count as a question, though. It's a very good line. And the goodie bag goes to a question, not an answer. Anyone got anything? Any thoughts on the NHS? Books on the NHS?
Well, I think it can be therapeutic. I think you should also bear in mind that humour can be very dangerous. Stephen Leacock tells a story about how he told a joke that was so funny that a member of his audience died laughing. Now, we're no longer allowed to tell jokes that are that funny anymore for health and safety reasons, which is why I don't hear any of those today.
Yeah.
But the immense satisfaction that this gave him, that he'd actually been able to kill a member of his audience. But he said that the strange thing was that no member of the audience laughed at any of his other jokes after that.
Any further thoughts on that, or shall we move on to another question?
Well, since health, it enables me to tell you, because I don't see how I can work this into a book, my best spontaneous joke. Because, you know, this was one of the ones that you think of afterwards, normally. But I thought of it at the time. And this is when I broke my shoulder a couple of years ago and I had this horrible National Health sling. You know the colour they are, that horrible pink thing. And I took it off when I came home and I dropped it on the floor with a sort of ugh gesture. And a friend came to visit me and he had a hernia and he had a truss. And he came in bitterly complaining about this truss and went up to the bathroom to take it off because it was digging into him and he was in absolute agony. And he came down carrying this truss and whinging and moaning and he dropped it, as it happened, beside the sling. And I said, ah, the slings and trusses of outrageous fortune.
Very good. Excellent. Thank you very much. We probably have time for one more question, I would say. Yes.
I was just going to say that it was interesting. You talked about Raymond Chandler. I think my husband would probably have a bit of an issue because I don't think he sees that as either being A, crime, because crime clearly isn't literary, and B, being funny. And I think that... I think
your husband needs to be spoken to.
Yes. But I just wondered whether there's anybody who'd gone up and said, you know, that you said, I really enjoyed your book, it was terribly funny, and you've been met with that
blank expression.
Yes. It wasn't set out to be amusing.
I don't know. I remember when I read Erica Jong's Fear of Flying. I thought it was one of the funniest books I'd ever read. And then I read her second book, and I can't remember what it was called, but it was about the same character, and it was clearly meant to be serious. And I mean, I think one was meant to take Fear of Flying seriously. And I found it absolutely hysterical, you know. It was about this terrible neurotic Jewish woman, has this happened to you ever?
No, but it'd be a form of torture, wouldn't it? Quite good. I mean, it's a thing to say to Hawken, for instance. Gosh, your books make me laugh. That would worry me.
Yeah, I wouldn't know how to handle it, actually. No.
Len?
I've lost it. What was the question?
Oh, the question was vaguely about, have you ever gone up to someone and misunderstood that something they thought was funny, you thought was... No, don't worry. Okay. Oh, I thought we were further ahead. I've just been told we have a little more time. So we could take another question. Yes, Lady in Green.
What do you think about the difference between British and American writers, for instance? Like, I found Elmore Leonard and Carl Hiaasen. Is there a significant difference in what kind of things end up being funny here?
Hawken, have you on that?
Yeah, I mean, when I lived in New York, I went around in the US, and but I didn't get this funny question. I got the question, what's the difference between the American way of writing and the Swedish way of writing? And I said that there is no Swedish way of writing, but there is a European way of writing. And but this doesn't come to into comics. It's just we have a slower pace, I think, than it is. But no, not really. I'm not sure about this.
Okay,
the comedy point.
Well, I've noticed that in America, they seem to appreciate the cosy novel a lot more than they do in this country, because I get a lot more emails from people in Philadelphia and Richmond, Virginia, saying that they enjoyed it than I do here. So
yes.
I think we're a little bit more...
But is it because they miss it over there? Do you have no cosiness? Is that why they like the European cosiness?
Well, they've got plenty of cosies of their own.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, the Americans have got
cozy is coming out of your ears.
That's
it?
Right.
Yeah.
Almost too many filters.
Ruth?
My best friends are Americans, really.
Right.
Yeah.
Do you think
like
it's just
an English quality, I think.
Do you think Americans are just more fulsome, more likely to get
in touch?
Bless
them. They're enthusiastic, which
is
very nice.
It
is. Yes,
I mean,
yes.
that is really, you know, we
even
should,
when
we,
you make fun of them, they
we
are.
All like going to American conventions where people come up saying, "We love your books."
Yes.
We you know, we do enjoy that very much. Len,
well, I think Americans certainly see a difference. On one particular American website where I was looking for my own book, I saw books were classified as hard boiled, cozy, and British.
Oh, I've been British cozy. I put the two together. Look, I think what we should do, because we're very near the end, is make this huge decision as to who gets the goodie bag.
Do we have to do this in public?
I don't think we've got room, and we can't have smoke coming out of the... Shall I make a suggestion? Shall I make a suggestion? Because it's flattering to us. I thought the question about our books being on the NHS was the one. Do any of the panellists feel that is awful?
Awful and good.
It doesn't. You're prepared to accept that.
I kill people
that.
In my books. I'm a good human woman.
Right. Okay. Well, with the lady who gets this prescription,
it did enable Ruth to make that marvellous joke.
Yes.
Thank you.
You
and
trust
me. Yes.
Thank you.
Anyway, thank you all very much for coming. We will just have a quick whinge about the fact that nobody makes money out of writing comedy, and indeed the shrewd people like Mark Billingham started writing a comic crime novel and then stopped because he and went to write his serious ones because they make so much more money. anyway, and also actually the comedy is quite difficult to translate
exactly.
Is another problem. So God, it's amazing that, you know, we managed to keep smiling. Yes. But thank you very much indeed for coming, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the weekend.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Oh, and we will be signing books.
Thank you.
All right.
I felt it was wasted. He didn't laugh.
I can always get it into one of your books.
And you've got to quick turnaround and straight on again, haven't you? Do talk
Well, that's it.
I wish I'd thought of it.